just writing a...
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. I want to thank everyone for being here today. We have a couple of informational meetings. The first panel, our first topic will be impact of Measure 11 on youth in Oregon. I understand that we have two panels, and if I've got this correct, the first three individuals listed, Roberta, Dr. Angela Moreland-Kupa?
Kupuya.
Kupuya? And is it Casa Rutledge? If y'all three would come forward, please. 30 seconds. Thank you all very much for coming to Salem today. And we just need you to each put your name on the record when you speak so we can just have that on the record. And who'd ever like to start off?
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Roberta Phillip Robbins. I'm chair of the Oregon Council on Civil Rights. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony to you today. The Oregon Council on Civil Rights serves to advise the Labor Commissioner, Brad Avakian, BOLI, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the state generally on matters related to education about and enforcement of civil rights in Oregon. Approximately 2 years ago, the council decided to address the issue of mass incarceration and related disproportionality in the criminal justice system. As we dug deeper into those issues, we agreed that due to developments in brain science and positive youth development as a field, the state of Oregon should reevaluate how and why we incarcerate children who are some of our most vulnerable. As a preview to what you'll hear today, the report presents and will also discuss today cutting-edge brain science, data analysis, an updated perspective on the legal landscape regarding the incarceration of children particularly, and the perspective of those who are most affected, young people experiencing incarceration under Measure 11. The council presents the following policy solutions, which you will find in our report. We recommend that the state of Oregon remove all children from adult prosecution under Measure 11 and return to a discretionary waiver system, which is leaving discretion with judges. We recommend more transparent data collection from prosecutors' offices and law enforcement. We recommend that we give all incarcerated children the option of a second look hearing. We know that young people have a unique capacity to grow and change, and our practices and policies should reflect that understanding. We recommend that the state address root causes. Oregon should invest further upstream and into the safety net programs that decrease involvement in the criminal justice system in the first place, programs that stabilize working families and those who live at the margins. Thank you for holding a hearing on this critical issue. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Normally, the way we will do this is we usually take all the testimony and then we open up for questions. But I'm going to ask the members if you want to do individually this today based on topics and subject matter. If not, then we're going to go ahead and take all the testimony, and then we'll open up for questions.
Great, thank you.
I would have one real quick question, since we're kind of in a pause here.
Yeah.
There have been different committees I've been on, and they've talked about youth. They've defined it from one age clear to, you know, another. What is the parameter? What is counting as youth here?
Well, if according to the legal definition, adult is 18, but what we're discussing is adult treatment for young people who are as young as 14 and 15 into the criminal justice system.
Okay, so just to clarify, you're talking about 18 and younger to
yes,
be
correct.
Removed from. All right, thank you for clarifying. It sounds like a dumb question, but seriously, in other committees,
no, thank you for the question.
Up to 26, so here we go.
Well, and we are going to talk a little bit about that. I mean, I think it is a legitimate question because most of the data around criminal justice is between 18 to 25, so that's probably why you're posing the question, but a very relevant one. And so with that, I'll let you know who I am. I am Dr. Alicia Moreland Capuia. And I am on faculty at OHSU in the Department of Psychiatry, where I work as an addiction psychiatrist, and also have for the last 5 years worked in the area of criminal justice reform through employing trauma-informed practices, cultural responsivity, and helping folks understand brain science and why it's relevant. So thank you, Chair Przanski and the committee here today for taking the time to engage with us. I have about 10 minutes. I'm going to use about seven of those 10 minutes to really engage you in a conversation. I think many of you are probably aware of the fact that every one of us in this room has a brain because we're here and you're sitting and you're engaging and you're thinking. But what we don't always think about is how our brains and how they developed is the same way that the folks that we seek to better serve is the same way that their brains were supposed to develop. And so I want to start the conversation in this way. I think that the country has began to recognize the fact that science is important, and it's only as important to the extent that we employ it in a meaningful way. So the way that the brain develops is from the bottom up and the inside out. Did you see the movie Outside In? Or Inside Out? Outside In? Did you see it? Did you see it? Inside Out? Outside In? That's Inside Out. But the brain develops from the bottom up and the inside out. And the movie Inside Out is actually a really good neurobiologically sound movie. So if you haven't seen it, see it with your children. But the point is that when each of us were first born, the most developed part of our brain was the bottom part. And why do we care? Because it's the bottom part of the brain that helps us to be able to breathe and our hearts to beat and for us to have a fear response. And so I like to say that each of us were born with the proclivity for survival. That's what each of us were born with. And then over the process, from the process of the brain starting to develop, and it actually develops at the point of conception, when sperm meets egg, that's when brain development actually starts. And then it starts to sort of curve off. It goes from that point of conception, until about the age of 26, to your question, Senator Thatcher. And that is, we start off with this proclivity for survival, each and every one of us. And when we're surviving, we're not necessarily at the top part of our brain. Again, brain develops from the bottom up and inside out. It takes time. And if you think about how precious and how tenuous the brain development process is normally, it would not be outside of the realm of possibility to recognize that there are multiple things that could potentially disrupt that brain development process. So I told you what the bottom part of the brain does, and I'm simplifying this for our conversation today. The bottom is responsible for survival, fear response, emotional management, and it basically helps us to seek safety and keeps us alive. Well, what does the top do, which is the last to develop? The top part of the brain, also known as the cortex, is responsible for helping us do things like exercise good judgment, to think before we speak, right? To be able to have sophisticated motoric actions. And the example I give, each of you have seen a scary movie. We're having a conversation today. It's okay to talk. Each of you seen a scary movie?
Yes, we have.
Do you know you're watching a scary movie? And I used to watch what we call Freddy Krueger movies. And Freddy Krueger would be behind, running, said characters running to get to the door, fleeing, trying to run away to get to safety. They've got the key in their hand and trying to get the key into the lock. What happens to that key?
Drop it.
What happens? You're right. They drop the darn key. And you probably would too. And why? The question is why? You've got something behind you. You've got threat behind you. You're running from it. You drop the key. Well, it turns out that that response, which each of us have all had, that fear response, right, that is mediated by the bottom part of the brain, is very active at that point. And it turns out that the top part of the brain, which is where our sophisticated thinking executive function comes from, and that motoric sophistication that's required to get that key in the lock, is compromised when you're afraid. Have you been afraid? Have you ever been afraid in your life? That's the real question. So I'm asking this question and asking each of you to think about the impact of things like fear. What we recognize is that each of us, and I'm going to do air quotes because it's equivocal, theoretically have been able to have the privilege to have what we call normal brain development. We've been in safe environments for the most part that allow that process of the brain to develop from the bottom up and the inside out that gets us to the point where we can make good decisions and really actively think about what we're doing. That's a normal process. But what I submit to you and would ask you to consider is, what about the folks among us who've always had Freddy Krueger running behind them, who've lived in conditions where they're always running from some said threat, whether that's poverty, whether that is trauma, whether that is hunger, whether that is just basically is what Maslow would call in the 1948s in his hierarchy of needs, not getting the basic needs met, and that is food, water, safety, loving, and belongingness. What we are dealing with is a population of young people who take away all of the initial social threats that folks have just trying to grow up. But then you add on it the insult of these additional, what I call psychosocial stressors, which does impact the brain ability to be able to actively work in the way that it should. So what you end up with is folks living mainly in the bottom part of their brain, surviving. And if I'm surviving, I'm doing it at the risk of being able to be in the top part of my brain, which is a privilege. The privileged part of my brain is where I'm able to think and actively engage. So all of that to say, I wanted to have the conversation to really illustrate with you is that the conversation that I think we're having today and across this country is super important. The brain matters. How it develops matters. The impact the impact that systems like our criminal justice system has on that developmental process matters. Here's the good thing. What we know from a neuroscientific standpoint is the brain can heal. And we get to be members and parts in helping the brain to heal by rethinking how we effectively do this. Our concern is not about rehabilitation, but it's about habilitation. There's a difference. We can't reheat something that's never been heated, right? But if we focus on providing skills and helping the brain to heal, which it can, then I think that we do a better job. So I will in there, but hope that you will actively, again, I appreciate your time, but hope that you would actively think about this process of brain development, the role that we can play in helping to create healthier conditions for better brain development so that the folks that we tend to want to serve more effectively are able to be everything that we believe that they can be. And at this point, I don't believe that Measure 11 supports that idea. So we've got to rethink it. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Cassia Rutledge, and I was a public defender for almost the last 10 years. I recently left to do capital defense work, so I represent people that the court appoints me who are facing the death penalty now. And I'm here kind of to tell you a little bit about the legal side and the personal side of representing kids charged with Measure 11 crimes. In the time that I was a public defender and now, I represent 15-year-olds and up, 15, 16, 17-year-olds charged in adult court facing adult convictions for one of 16 Measure 11 crimes. And there are some significant ways in which it is very clear to me and everybody else who represents juveniles facing Measure 11s that kids are different than how we represent adults. The first one being that when my clients, when I'm appointed to represent a 15, 16, or 17-year-old facing adult Measure 11, they become part of the adult system. They get an adult public defender, they have an adult prosecutor, and they face all the same requirements about bail and pretrial release that adults do. And what that means with Measure 11 is that the mandatory bail on a Measure 11 charge is $250,000 per count. So if you are facing two or three Measure 11 charges, you can get up to almost $500,000 pretty quickly. Those are reducible to $50,000 by a judge, but only by a judge. A pretrial release officer can't do that, so you have to have a hearing, and that takes some time. Judges can reduce it lower than $50,000 if the counsel makes an effective finding that it would be constitutionally impermissible to hold a juvenile in custody, because they're not able to post $50,000 on each count. And I will tell you, I've had judges rule that my clients who were juveniles should stay in juvenile detention. The other part about that that happens is they stay in juvenile detention until 18. But the way that our structure of juvenile detention is the second they turn 18, the morning they turn 18, they get a rude wake-up call at juvenile detention. They're rolled up and they're driven to MCDC in Portland or Inverness. They're taken to an adult facility. So you have these 18-year-old kids who just turned on their birthday and they're taken to adult jail where they will sit until their trial or their plea. The second way that Measure 11, as applied to juveniles, is significantly different is Measure 11 provides the court limited to no discretion about how to handle the sentences and what is important to the judge in making a determination about how to handle this kid. So as the defense counsel, my job is to try and find legal defenses for my clients. It's to help my clients process through what it means to be facing a charge and to help them decide what the best options are for them. But a judge can only do so much with a Measure 11 charge. There are a few what we call escape hatches where a judge can make findings and say, instead of going to prison, you're going to probation. But those are very limited, and they're a risk to take a case to trial and hope that the judge is going to find that. So you would think that judges would want to hear about these kids, hear from their family, hear from their school, from their counselors, but Measure 11 makes that nearly impossible for them to be able to do in a meaningful way that affects the impact or the outcome of a Measure 11 charge. It also, the fourth reason that it's different for kids is that you don't get any good time earned time. What that means is it's a straight sentence, so you serve every single day of your incarceration. And if you're a juvenile, you're going to serve that in the juvenile detention facility up until your 25th birthday or the earlier termination of your sentence, whichever comes first. But you don't get any reduction for behaving, for following rules, for doing things correctly, for engaging in programming that helps you, for doing drug treatment, for doing mental health treatment. You don't get any time reduction off of your sentence for that. You serve every single day. And then lastly, and probably most significantly, you end up with an adult conviction. So this is a conviction where for the rest of your life, you're going to have to report to employers that you were convicted of a felony count. These are not expungible convictions. They will never leave a juvenile's record. So something that you may have done when you were 15, 16, or 17 is going to follow you literally for the rest of your life. So I want to talk a little bit about what that looks like. Most of the kids I've represented are charged with robbery 2, or assault 2, or kidnapping 2. So those are the lower level Measure 11 charges. And the reason that those are so important is because all of those are convictions you can get when you're hanging out with your friends and collectively you all make bad choices together. The most common Measure 11 I have ever represented somebody on is a robbery 2, which looks like this. Three or four kids go on their lunch break from their school to the local Fred Meyers, and one of them decides to shoplift a candy bar. And on the way out, the loss prevention officer says, hey, you guys, stop. I saw you take that candy bar. And my client, not the one who took the candy bar, maybe puts his body in the way of the loss prevention officer who's trying to get the guy who took the candy bar, maybe shoves him. All of a sudden, the guy who took the candy bar and my client are both facing robbery 2 charges because we have aid and abet theory. And what we know from the social science with kids is that peer relationships is super important at that age, and that kids will do really kind of dumb things in relationship to their peer group and their friend group. And so all of a sudden, you can find somebody facing 70 months in prison because they went to Fred Meyers and one of their buddies took a candy bar. I've had multiple cases like that, whether it happens on school grounds or Fred Meyers. And then when I'm appointed to represent them, it's difficult because now I've got a 16-year-old and I'm having to navigate the 16-year-old through an adult court system without really the capacity for them to understand or make decisions or understand or appreciate what has been done and what their future looks like. And as an attorney, that's a difficult thing to do. Also in adult court with kids in adult court,
access to parents and ability to have parents make decisions is very difficult. I speak to a lot of community groups, and the number one thing I hear from parents is, why can't I be in the meetings with my attorney and my kid, who's 15, 16? But adult rules apply and confidentiality kicks in. So you're taking a child, putting them in an incarcerated situation for something that I would venture to say several people in this room did as a child themselves, including yours truly, and then asking them to navigate a system that's very difficult to navigate. So the last thing I'll say about what it's like to defend a child accused of a Measure 11 is that putting Measure 11 on the table vastly changes the negotiations. When the district attorney decides to charge my client in adult court, we have gone from the little leagues to the major leagues. We are suddenly talking about adult convictions. We're talking about length of time in incarceration. If they were to charge that same act in juvenile court, it would be a very different process where the outcome would be substantially more related to the juvenile action. So now we're talking about whether or not what adult felony you're going to have, how long you're going to be incarcerated, if you're going to have an adult probation officer, as opposed to talking about getting the kid the services and the structure and the support that they need in order to make this a one-off, a blip that they're never going to have again. It just changes the entire conversation. So I appreciate your time today and listening to me, and I'll yield for any questions.
All right, thank you. We're open up for questions now. Senator Dimbrough first.
Thanks, Ms. Chair. I have a couple of questions. First, Ms. Rutledge, just following up on what you were just talking about. So if a juvenile commits a crime as a juvenile but is in juvenile detention, then turns 18 before the charges are filed or finalized, mm-hmm. or whatever, then they are tried as an adult? Yes, even though they were a child when the crime occurred?
Yes, so when the crime occurs, the district attorney's office gets to decide if they're going to charge that child as an adult or as a kid. And so they initiate charges in adult court if they want to charge them, with a Measure 11. Then it proceeds in adult court, even though they stay in juvenile detention until they turn 18. Does that answer your question? Sorry.
Yes. It does. I'm just trying to understand. So even though they're a child at the time they committed the crime, and, going to Dr. Moreland Capuia's sort of asking us to think in those terms of what that brain is like.
I can talk to you a little bit more about, because even given some of her testimony, I would reframe some of the words a little different, is that when we consider so if we think about the risk factors that would cause a young person to become entangled with the law in the first place, right? Let's put those to the side for a moment and just think about the fact that we were once 14-year-olds, and you probably have a 14-year-old. To ask them to think before they act is really a good high goal, but it usually is very difficult given the fact that the brain just does not mature in terms of that prefrontal cortex until around the age of 26. It doesn't mean that they're not capable and have the capacity. But what I want us to think about is adding on top of that potential insults to the process. So while you have an 18-year-old who may physically look like an 18-year-old, the brain may not have even caught up. So the question then really becomes, from a sort of a neuroscientific and neurobiological sort of standpoint, is it appropriate to charge someone who has, again, and there are many conditions that could potentially disrupt that process. Is it humane to charge someone in this particular system when their brain literally is not developed to that point? So in other words, they may not have an 18-year-old brain or even a 19-year-old brain. And so that's where I come in and ask folks to consider factors like trauma or the role for trauma, or again, just not having basic needs met, coming from neglect environment. So I think that we have a real opportunity here to match what we know scientifically with what we do practically. I just don't think the law has caught up yet.
I think I follow up.
If you're going to follow up on that, if not, I want to ask Ms. Rutledge to follow up on your last question.
Okay, why don't you? And actually, it's a little bit different line, so why don't you?
Okay. So, Ms. Rutledge, my understanding also is that in the prosecuting world, that there's a decision that's made by that office as to when to charge an individual. So a person who actually commits a crime at age 17, if it's close to their birthday, if they're not formally charged before they're 17, I'm not saying measure 11, but they wait until 18, then they are going to be charged as an adult, even though the offense occurred when they were still a juvenile.
Thank you for the question, Senator Przanski. That is correct.
All right. And then the other part on this, I wanted to clarify, because you caught my ear when you said this, about the issue about confidentiality of youth that are charged with Measure 11. Mm-hmm. If they were not charged with a Measure 11 and they stayed within the juvenile system, is there still confidentiality between the attorney, the youth, if the parents are involved in the discussions between the two?
Thank you again for that question. The answer is yes. The difference for me is where they're housed. Well, twofold, where they are housed and where and the way that attorneys are trained on how to interact with the children. So when my clients are in MCDC or IJ, all of their phone conversations are recorded except for the ones with their attorney. So if they wanted to talk, and that in-person visits as well. So if they wanted to talk with their parent about what they should do, how to navigate things, they're not able to do that without that phone call being recorded and therefore their words potentially used against them. When my clients are under 18 and housed in juvenile detention, those phone calls between parents and kids are not recorded, nor are the visits. So there are ways for them to communicate confidentially with their parents to be able to make these decisions in a different way. So as an adult court, what that means for me and my juvenile clients is I oftentimes have to schedule settlement conferences where then I ask the judge if it's okay for my client and their parents to communicate, if that makes sense. I also, I feel like juvenile attorneys who just do juvenile work have a better sense of how to navigate the parent-child relationship than a lot of us who do mostly adult work and then have children that we represent as well.
All right. Back to Senator Ambrose.
Yes. Thank you very much, Chair. Dr. Moreland Capuia, and by the way, I knew the Capuias back when your husband was a kid.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Wonderful family.
Thank you.
You know, I feel like I've often seen kids who are in the Oregon Youth Authority who probably went in under those kinds of stressful conditions that you described where, you know, they're just kind of dominated by fear and anxiety and not really able to make, you know, adult decisions, rational decisions, executive mm-hmm. function decisions.
Right.
And then over their time in OYA, they are able to learn those, both through a combination of the treatment that they receive and also just the fact that maybe they feel safe for the first time. But then they face the prospect of moving to adult system where, you know, maybe that fear is going to start regenerating, you know, and coming back. And, you know, I'm just wondering how... You know, if you've seen that happen, and you know, if that is a reason to keep kids in the OYA system as long as possible.
Well, I would say, just in general, thank you for the question. In general, in the last 5 years that I've worked with the criminal justice system and particularly youth, what I have discovered is that this being institutionalized in any capacity, whether or not it's in the youth system versus the adult system, has impacts on the brain and its ability to heal. If we're looking at this in terms of a lesser of two evils, the youth system does tend to lend itself more to the process of understanding the role of trauma and also creating safety in some sense in order to begin the process of healing compared to the adult system. And part of it is some of the leadership within that system. I know that that there was a huge focus on groups like Seeking Safety, which looks at, you know, trauma and substance use. So there is a specific focus, again, on this process of habilitation, helping folks to build skills that they can use to then employ once they leave. And that's more prevalent and predominant in the youth system, more so than the adult system. I think the adult system is working to catch up. But if I had a vote, it would be that we would rethink this and think about getting folks into treatment in environments outside of institutions like, you know, prisons and jails, and helping them to learn to effectively navigate this world we call life and give them a chance to actually be positive contributing members, which is indeed possible. The brain changes and it does have the opportunity to heal, and if we create the right conditions, that definitely can and will occur.
Senator Lutheran, thank you. I thought you had your hand up first, though.
I'm coming after.
Okay, sir. Senator Gelser.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. And I appreciate this is maybe a controversial question, but I have this picture of, you know, Freddy Krueger chasing you your whole life and making decisions based out of fear. You end up in this institutionalized environment and your entire life is changed, probably setting up a new cycle of for the next generation of kids of being chased by Freddy Krueger. At what point do you think that policymakers should look at applying brain science and brain development to our child welfare policy to make difficult decisions earlier so that kids aren't being chased by Freddy Krueger and into the Oregon Youth Authority?
Yeah, this DHS question, so I have to be careful how I answer that, too. Thank you for the question. I do believe, so if we are looking at this from a public health approach, right, there is the upstream, the midstream, and downstream. And, of course, upstream is it would be really nice to prevent this in the first place. So it is, you know, I think that there's a larger discussion here about how we create safety nets and make sure that everyone has food and a place to stay, and also how we envision family, right? I think that in the past, when DHS has sort of removed kids from their families, that it has caused more trauma and harm than actually working to try to reconstitute the family and work with the family as a unit. So part of what I know that in the past that I've sort of recommended is that DHS really look at how to start with, you know, parenting classes and skills building and really supporting families being whole, whatever definition of family that is for folks, and really trying to help them work around the trauma. Because the bottom line is that trauma and fear doesn't happen in a vacuum, and kids don't heal, and youth don't heal in a vacuum. So there has to be policies around helping to support the and strengthen and undergird the family as a unit, right? And what we tend to find is that trauma is intergenerational, and it is passed down from the gene level, down from mRNA to DNA, right? And what we also know from epigenetics is that certain things can be turned on and turned off. So wouldn't it be great if we taught families how to manage their trauma? Wouldn't it be great if we taught families how, in stressful situations, to do mindfulness together as a family? Because the science around that has demonstrated that mindfulness heals the brain, right? These are just some thoughts, but I do believe that there are some opportunities that we have to work with the family as a system and to not punish, because I think that's what it feels like. It feels like punishment when children are removed and not able to heal with their family.
All right. I hate to do this. I'm going to ask have Senator Lithicum make his question. We're kind of getting behind. We have another panel. Plus, we have another informational hearing. This is very eye-opening, awakening type of concepts of discussions for legislation. I'll just put on the record, I expect that we'll continue to have these discussions during the interim through a work group process.
Awesome. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Stay seated.
Fight or flight.
You've painted an interesting picture with regard to the development of the brain in our minds and how that pans out. And it seems like we've created an environment where we somewhat eliminate individual freedom and personal responsibility, because the claim is we are our brains are subject to all the trauma and development and DNA and gene pool development that has happened within our family sphere or whatnot. And I'm wondering how do we as a legislature come to grips with the idea that individuals have responsibility, and where are those ages appropriate and not appropriate? Because the individual who you described in a scenario, you know, at the local grocery store gets into trouble and did something and it was a response. And so getting back into faith and family and a home and a safe environment sounds more amenable than, you know, the prison cell. And I think we all buy that. But nevertheless, there's this construct going where we've got this evolutionary, you know, biological kind of concrete form to what this human is going to grow up and be and do and achieve. And I think that's a mistaken notion. And so I'm just looking for hints on how to cash that out.
So in your question is?
The question, well, specifically, we've got these gradients here that we can all see and we can all recognize. Right now, the state has made a line at 18.
Yes.
Where would those gradients fall?
I see. So I want to address one thing quickly, and I know I'm sorry that we're taking a lot of time, but I think it's important and interesting, and I'll try to be very brief here. It's very interesting to me, because I think what we also have to acknowledge and consider is that there disproportionately certain groups are able to make mistakes and be in their prefrontal cortex and are not necessarily punished as harshly as others, right? So there's another underlying element here. There's some subtext that we haven't got to, things like race and racism, and that's a discussion for another day. And then there's this component of, again, when you understand how the brain develops just normally and where people are normally, it's not an excuse, right? So it doesn't alleviate the need for still holding someone accountable. But it says what it really asks is to reconsider and to restructure systems and their response to someone when they come in it, right? So it is understanding that the old way of doing things is not going to help move someone towards healing. So we're not asking, we're saying if you've hurt someone, then yes, there should be some consequence and an opportunity for grace and an opportunity for healing and an opportunity for a future. So the door should not be completely closed. And that means we have to consider the fact that someone who's 18 may not be 18, and we need to be thinking about maybe extending that this whole thing to 25. That would be my argument, that we're looking at this sort of emerging adulthood phase, and that actually is a thing. There is this emerging adulthood, and some psychologists would argue that that's until 40. That period from 20, seriously, honestly and seriously. And gender, it breaks down along gender lines, but I don't want to start any fights here today. So I think we do have to start thinking about that. And I think that's a good question, that maybe 18 is not the number. 18 is, it's not okay to send folks. And then we've got a lot of contradictions. You can go and fight a war, but you can't drink or buy cigarettes, right? So there are a lot of contradictions that I think we have to deal with as well. So.
Very teasing. Thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you.
All right, our second panel is going to be Dr. Lehman, Noah Schultz, and Bobin Singh. And gentlemen, I hate to say this, we are running a little bit behind on time, so if you could just keep that in mind in your presentations,
okay.
Please.
I'll attempt to keep it short.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Brzezanski, and the rest of the committee for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Dr. Mark Lehman. I'm an assistant professor of criminology and criminal justice at Portland State University. As an academic and a researcher, my job is an endeavor to work within what we know to be factually supported by sound research. I endeavor to understand what is happening and why it is happening. So in that vein, I've been asked today to discuss what is the research and data around Measure 11. I will specifically be talking about information on length of sentence and racial disparities within the system. Between 1995 and 2012, nearly 4,000 Oregon 15, 16, and 17-year-olds will refer to adult court under Measure 11. According to Pew Charitable Trust, Oregon has the second highest rate of youth referral to adult court after Florida. This, of course, is largely a reflection of Measure 11. Sentencing Project noted that in 2013, youth imprisonment rates were twice that of our neighbors to the north, Washington, and 42% higher than California, our neighbors to the south. Of those referred to adult court, 11 were under the age of 12 when they committed their crime. Another 100 were under the age of 14 when they committed their crimes. Of the relative long list of 21 crimes that make up Measure 11 offenses, almost half, 47%, fall within three offenses: assault 2, robbery 1, and robbery 2. While these are not crimes without their seriousness, these offenses of murder or manslaughter, typically seen as the most violent of crimes, only account for 2.6% of all Measure 11 offenses. The vast majority of referrals are within the lower level offense of Measure 11 offenses. Of those convicted of Measure 11 offenses, the average sentence was 70 months, or a little less than 6 years. Though youth of color and white youth receive about the same average sentence, youth of color are significantly more likely to receive a Measure 11 referral. Black youth make up 16% of all Measure 11 referrals, yet only account for about 2% of the general population of Oregon. Across all 21 Measure 11 offenses, Black youth were 13.6 times more likely to be referred than white youth. To put that another way, Black youth were almost 1,300% more likely to be referred. Among the top three offenses mentioned earlier, assault 2, robbery 1, and robbery 2, Black youth were 24 times more likely to be referred. Robbery 2 alone, the rate is 44 times that of white youth. Put another way, that's 4,300% more likely to be referred. The disparity alone among robbery 1 and robbery 2 is so large that those two offenses account for 80% of the racial disparity among Measure 11 referrals. Further, the racial disparity has increased over time, from a low of 7.3 in 1995 to a high of 26 in 2012, more than tripling since the law went into effect. This is especially troubling because the number of overall Measure 11 referrals have been trending down in the last 5 years. Concern with Measure 11 is not a new issue. In 2012, the Oregon Commission on Public Safety to the governor outlined concerns with the automatic waiver and noted the need to extend earned time reductions. The commission noted that many of the commissioners had recommended these recommendations for change, but a consensus could not be reached. Among the academic and research community, Oregon's criminal justice system, especially how it treats youth under Measure 11, is not seen as innovative or enlightened. Scholarly research has questioned the wisdom of long sentences, especially among youth. Research has generally shown that little to no real deterrent effect of long sentences exists. Research has shown that youth with an adult on felony conviction face significant barriers to long-term post-prison success, including higher rates of unemployment, poverty, and substance abuse, and are more likely to reoffend. According to Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, it costs $263 a day to house a youth in the Oregon Youth Authority facility. The average Measure 11 sentence costs the state of Oregon over $500,000 per youth. The financial costs coupled with the human costs of Measure 11 make the law suspect. Measure 11 was passed during a time when fear drove many of our criminal justice policies. Armed with 25 years of new research on crime in the criminal justice system, Measure 11 does not hold up under modern understandings. While much is known, more is needed. Oregon can collect more data, especially on the processes related to prosecutorial decision-making and plea deals. With more robust data, we can draft policies that will help push Oregon forward. So I look forward to answering any questions you might have. And I know there was a lot of numbers in there, so I'm happy to share them with you if you would like.
Thank you. Who would like to go next?
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you, Council Members, Senate Prozanski. My name is Noah Schultz. I'm a youth advocate and program instructor. And in 2009, I was sentenced to a Measure 11 crime. Shortly after my 17th birthday, I received a 7.5-year sentence, which led me to be sent to Oregon Youth Authority for that full time. Prior to that sentence, prior to that crime, I lived in that state of fight or flight. This was a time in my life that was the most tumultuous period of my life, to where my parents, my mom had ran away from our family household. My mom was the foundation of our family household. I was involved with selling drugs from 12 years old up until that 17th year. So nothing, the streets weren't new to me. That was something I was involved in a very early age. But when I was 16 and my mom had left, things impacted myself and my family on a different level. My mom was the foundation of our household, and she's what kept everything together. And without her there, everyone began to lose it. And the way I began to deal with that was finding the people who accepted me. That was the gang that I was a part of in the streets. And I fell deeper into the street life, deeper into that culture, and began trying to drown out that reality of what was around me with those kinds of behaviors. And I was not in my right mind, and you could ask my high school teachers at that time that I just began falling off completely. I was robbed that same year, and in retaliation to that, I ended up committing my crime. And I turned myself in that night. I turned myself in that night and ended up in the questioning room and then sent to Donnelly Long. I was in Donnelly Long for 9 months awaiting my sentence. When I received my sentence, I was told that I was going to begin nothing under 80, nothing over 80, nothing under 70. I was called and told that I was going to be given 90 months. From that point, I was sent throughout the system. I was sent to MCDC. I was sent to Inverness. I was sent to Coffee Creek. From Coffee Creek, I was sent to Hillcrest. From Hillcrest, I finally made my way to McLaren Youth Correctional Facility. So this crazy experience of being bounced around all these different facilities, and I finally made my way to McLaren. Now, when I was in that cell that whole time, for that 9-month period awaiting the sentence, I decided that I wanted to do something different. I decided that my behaviors and my actions weren't going to take me to where I thought I was meant to go in life. I wanted something bigger in my life. And I was able to take advantage of the opportunities that were presented to me in McLaren. And we made some opportunities for ourselves. One of them was high school. High school and school in general, it was just something I was not very involved with growing up. And I began getting involved with the high school program, and I graduated with my high school diploma. Shortly after that, I graduated with my associate's degree from Lane Community College. Shortly after that, I graduated with 2 bachelor's degrees from Oregon State University. In that time, I excelled. I did everything and anything that they said was going to get me to that better point in life. And I usually asked myself, I wondered, because I felt so many times I had outgrown this cage. I had outgrown everything that was being given to me. And there was no way that I could present that to somebody, such as the second look hearing, to show them, hey, I've changed. I'm different from my 17-year-old self. I'm 23 years old right now, and I'm an emerging leader. I'm ready to get out into the community. I'm ready to drive this impact in the spaces and areas that I know that I can touch. But still, that's just not an option. It's a day-for-day sentence. So I sat, and I continued to wait, and I continued to do my best while I was in the facility. And 2016, I was released, and I came back to Portland, came back to my home, and I began this journey of transition, as an adult. And when a young person goes into these facilities and they're given such a large amount of time and they come back out into the community, it's like a cold shower. We didn't have experience being adults prior to this. Taxes, housing, everything. These are all new challenges. And being 26 now, everyone expects you to know these things. So we're in some ways very behind our peer group when we do come out. Now I'm watching my friends struggle with housing. I'm watching my friends struggle with employment. And I look back at these mistakes that we made as young people, and I look back at who we were as young people and who we are as adults now, and acknowledge that that's something that's always going to be hanging over our heads. Now, that may, what we're trying to do here may not change my circumstance or my friend's circumstance, but we have to at least do it for these next generations. Because I can tell you right now, as someone who has done everything and someone who is even seen as a poster child for OIA, these struggles are impacting me on a very personal level day by day. And I'm seeing them impact my friends too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Brzezinski, Chair. Senator Brzezinski and the members of the committee. I'm just going to try to wrap this up very quickly. I think what our report...
Bobbin, I need you to put your name on the record.
Oh, sorry. My name is Bobbin Singh. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Justice Resource Center and a member of the Oregon Council on Civil Rights. And I was fortunate enough to be on the council to help produce this report and also my organization to help support in the production of this report. So, like I said, I'm going to try to wrap this up because I know we're running out of time. But what I want to fundamentally say is that our report is saying that treating youth as adults, which Measure 11 does, when you're charged as a 15, 16, or 17-year-old with a Measure 11 crime, you're automatically placed into the adult court system. And what we're saying is that that automatic referral, that statutory exclusion, that treatment of youth as adults is fundamentally inconsistent with science. It's inconsistent with the research is showing us as what is the best way to be able to hold youth accountable. So what we are saying is that, are asking is, the question is, how can we create a system that actually recognizes and appreciates the complexities of youth development, their lives, the unique situations of their cases and circumstances of whatever brought them to the criminal justice system, and how best to be able to create a justice system that ensures that they are able to move on from this experience or this touch with the justice system in productive ways. So we want to think about how to create a system that's going to be more effective for the community from a public safety standpoint, that's going to allow youth to be able to continue on in their lives and ultimately be better citizens for the states, and also really just better, what is better policy for the state, both from a cost perspective, but just also from, I think, a moral perspective. And Measure 11, by all standards, is a failure as it applies to youth. The report that we were able to produce is the first of its kind. What we wanted to do was use science and research to guide the conversation forward. So our hope is that as we move forward, we can embrace a policy conversation where science and research is really the focus of how we make decisions. And I think what we heard today is that, you know, youth are different. As Dr. Lehman has presented to us, the data shows that Measure 11 is disproportionately harming certain communities far greater than other communities. And our role as a Civil Rights Council is to bring that information forward to you. And so it's exciting to know this conversation will continue to move forward in the work group. And our hope is that our policy recommendations are adopted and presented to a future legislative session to be codified in Oregon law, and to hopefully, as Noah mentioned, to ensure that the next generation of youth that are being touched by the justice system, that we're doing our best to, that they can come back out and we're not creating, in essence, two victims out of a single event. I'm happy to take any questions, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you all very much. Let's see if there's any pressing questions at this point. If not, gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Noah, thank you for coming forward and being willing to share your personal story with us. I don't know how, if you realize the impact it does have on us as individuals in making decisions for the state to actually have the reflection of individuals who have walked that experience. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that's going to conclude our informational hearing on the impact of Measure 11 on youth in Oregon. What we're going to go ahead and close that one. We'll open up our second informational hearing, strengthening the safety of our campus communities. And Jace, why don't you go ahead and come up? It looks like we have two Jameses joining you as well. James Bennett and James Boussain.
Very good. Boussain.
Boussain.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Jason, I'm going to let you start off.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Chair, Senator Pazansky. My name is Jay Smith. I am the secretary of an organization called the Oregon College and University Public Safety Administrators Association, and I'm also the chief public safety officer for Lane Community College and the director of emergency management there.
Good morning. I'm James Bouzian. I'm the president of the Oregon College Public Safety Administrators Association, also the director of public safety, Oregon State University Cascades in Bend, Oregon.
Good morning. Jim Bennett. I'm the executive director of OCUPSA as well, and a former campus public safety chief.
Good morning. I'll take it from here. Thank you for your attention on this important matter. I would like to share with you that while our institutions are deeply committed to safety on campuses, what you're going to hear today are the views and perspectives of our association. We're solely representing our association today. So three important points we're going to go over are enhancing our campus safety overall. We believe our college communities, students, faculty, staff, guests, are the jewels of all of our communities, and we share all those spaces, and we'd like to see them be safer. We are going to propose some standardized training, overall standards in the ORS, and capabilities of our campus departments to better interoperate with our municipal partners and deputy sheriff departments. We're looking to provide clear and consistent statutory authority that maximizes safety for all of us. So a little bit about our association. Our mission is to bring together the collective views of the chiefs, directors, managers of 25 or more institutions all across the state of Oregon, public, private, college, universities. Everyone's welcome to join. Our mission is solely to look at how our trainings and opportunities can advance the mission of campus safety in our communities. I mentioned some of the departments, and this is kind of important as we go through our presentation today. There are varying levels of institutions, how they manage their safety. There's security departments, which if you think of basic DPSST 14-hour security level, like a loss prevention officer, checking doors, providing parking security in parking lots, very low level. The next level is campus safety departments or public safety departments. That's a higher level of statutory authority, much deeper level of involvement on the campus, and what they can do on the campus providing security, including stop and frisk, probable cause, and traffic enforcement. Then, of course, you have sworn police departments. So that's kind of the field of what you have out there. And there's only three sworn police departments currently, University of Oregon, OHSU, and Portland State University, fully sworn municipal-style police departments. So those services are important, those models, because as we look at the ORS statutes, there's varying degrees of how those authorities are granted and what these agencies are allowed to do, which can impact their ability to interoperate and provide the level of service an institution may want to do. Patrol services, which is your basic security person, may be in uniform. They may or may not have some defensive tools, pepper spray, baton, that kind of a thing. They're essentially your security guard, and that's 14 hours of training, certification, very minimal. Some institutions have that level out there. A significant percentage are campus public safety departments. They have between 100 and 500 hours of training. That varies based upon the institution. Some of that can be very structured. Western Association of College Law Enforcement, they provide a structured training for Idaho, Washington, California. Is it Utah as well?
Montana. British Columbia.
And DPSST used to provide that level of training. That stopped, I believe, in 2006. So these agencies in that middle group, they'll provide their own training, hire other certified DPSST qualified people, and then they'll put their officers through that level of training to give them that higher level of professionalism and safety for their campus community. Then, of course, you have fully sworn law enforcement or commissioned departments, and those function at the exact same level of any other police department with all the benefits that come with that level of interoperability, access to grants, you know, how they operate, access to training, that kind of thing.
Comment?
Yes, please.
So I'd like to make a comment about what he just said in terms of levels of training. Currently in the state of Oregon, DPSST requires that public community colleges and private organizations, private colleges and universities, that they get the 14 hours of training. Even though we are a public entity, I represent Lane Community College, even though we're public, that is a training that's required by DPSST. And it's a private security licensure, which is completely inappropriate and not a right fit for our organization. At Lane Community College alone, we have 400 hours of training, which covers what an officer needs to know in order to do the job that they can under the statute. So I wanted to clarify that because that's one of the things that we've had a conversation with DPSST about, and changing that and relinquishing the requirement for licensure, because we have no licensure currently for community colleges that's required other than this private security licensure, which is not a fit for essentially government employees. Anyway.
Thank you. Jim?
No, go ahead.
Okay. So the services that we're providing, if you think about what we're doing on those campuses, it's essentially a subset of any of the other communities that you represent. The same level of interaction, whether they're coming there for arts, music, or why they're coming there to get an education, but also the thefts, the crime, the threats, and sadly you may have caught as you came into the room today, there was a homicide on Central Michigan University today on the campus too. So the threats don't go away as you drive onto the, you know, the campus, the college or the university, private or otherwise. So we're looking at how those service delivery models can be enhanced. I mentioned the private security, which is the basic level. That's the first bullet point there. It's fairly minimal, unlocking doors, making sure. Think of it as observe and report. They see something, they're going to call somebody else. They're going to call the local sheriff or call the local police department. As you get down into this lower list, what we wanted to illustrate for you is these campus public safety departments are doing a full menu of professional police type services without having that commissioning standard. DPSST did a study in 2005 looking at a job task analysis, and they found a significant portion of what we do on our campuses is very similar to what law enforcement does. Responding, investigating, mitigating, crisis intervention, post-traumatic intervention, medical, investigating thefts, sexual assaults, and then there's some added nuances and complexities. We have the Jean Cleary Act and some other federal standards, FERPA, where we cannot share certain things and law enforcement can't share certain things with us because of that either real or perceived disparity on our authorities, which we're going to talk about a little bit later. We have a solution for you. So that's what this list is representing. This is just a very short list, and there's time and effort and training to get people up to a functional and professional skill set to interact with our students, faculty, staff, and community that comes onto these campuses.
If you could go back to the previous slide.
Yes.
What I say there is indeed a lot of tasks that we would associate with traditional police officers, right? And yet, as I look at that list, and I think, you know, I'm coming at this from, I taught at a community college for many years, and, you know, have had deep friendships and respect for, you know, people who worked in, you know, as part of our public safety operation. And, you know, what I'm not seeing on that list is more along the lines of what we think of as community policing, you know, because I find that those officers, the really successful ones, I mean, there were some that were kind of short term, they ended up washing out because they wanted too much to be doing that list, right? But the soft skills they didn't really have in terms of building a community and, you know, making people feel comfortable and welcome. And I mean, there is that side of it. And I wonder if you could speak to that.
I would love to, if I can respond to that. One of the things I'm most proud of in my department is we have a philosophy of the lowest level of enforcement possible in any engagement with anyone. And the officers get training on community policing and just how to have conversations with folks and to get out of the car. We have a bike patrol unit, we do foot patrol, and we do motor vehicle patrol, and we do traffic law enforcement on our campus as well. And of all the contacts we have, especially for traffic law enforcement, probably 80% of those are warnings. They're either verbal or written warnings for whatever the ORS violation is. And it's very seldom that we'll issue a citation, and even more seldom that we'll arrest someone because of something that they've done. We always try to handle things at that lower level, and because we also do prevention programs and education and training for students, staff, and faculty, we teach domestic violence prevention education, sexual assault prevention education, workplace violence, personal safety. They see us in a lot of other roles than just enforcement. And the folks in my department, some of them do go on to become, and they're quickly snatched up by other law enforcement agencies in the state of Oregon. And that's great for those people that want to go on and do that particular kind of policing. But our style, we do have a lot of those soft skills. We are not focused on enforcement. We're focused on individuals being successful at school. We don't exist for our own purpose. We exist to support the mission of the school, which is to educate people and give people a chance. And you notice the young man that was here before said he got his degree from Lane Community College, and I was like, well.
I thought he said Oregon State University.
I think he said Lane Community
College. Maybe I'm wrong. Well, let's check the record.
But I hope I addressed your concern. At least I think that if I can speak for my department, I can't speak for others, but I know that largely we are very sensitive to the educational mission.
Right. And I would like to add a little bit more, Senator Denbrough, because this is actually critical, because there is a distinction with the difference between law enforcement. I'm a retired law enforcement officer, about 30 years experience in another state. Don't hold that against me. But we were enforcement-centric, working with the district attorney's office. You know, even though we did community policing, my agency was very proud of it. The shift into what I'm doing now is most of our mission statement, I would say probably without exception when we look at our colleagues, is education, mentoring, re-engagement, restorative justice. We want to actually do everything to keep them out of criminal justice system and into successful graduation. So that is actually very high on the list. The interesting piece of that is our municipal partners, some of them, understanding our culture on campuses is a bit more challenging because they have limited time and resources. They have to spend that on what they're doing for their larger part of the community. So you'll see at the end, we're proposing that interoperability, a force multiplier, where we're the experts on the campus, but we have some of those skills because those things are occurring on the campus. But when the officers need to go and do what they need to do, we're doing all the other soft skill stuff. Together, we're better together that way. Okay. So this slide just kind of represents the current statutes. Private security provider, the next one down is college officers in the peace officer role. It's distinguished and defined by traffic and parking. And Jace, would you like to add anything to that one?
No, really, that's it. The statute provides for community college officers to do traffic law enforcement and parking enforcement as peace officers.
Okay, and then in totality, this slide actually is the backbone of why we're here, because there is this creates a lack of clarity and mission. So the next one down, 352385, yeah, you actually changed that. That's 352118 now. And that grants universities, so it makes a distinction, a separation, stop and frisk, probable cause to arrest, and traffic and parking. And it distinguishes you cannot carry a firearm. And then the statutes allow for a sworn police department. And what we'll be suggesting is cleaning that up so there's equality across the board. You could still always be a police department with the distinction of the ordinance doesn't allow for, I believe, privates and colleges. So we'll come to that in a moment. And as you see, there's no special ORS for privates. Other states have that, and they support that. So our needs have changed. A dramatic threat environment has changed. I mentioned the shooting, but we can talk about many of those. Actually, I think for us, it's the day-to-day things that are going on the campus. There's just a lot more volume of everything. Things getting stolen, broken into, vandalism, those kinds of things. the challenges of free speech on campuses across the United States. Those are public safety departments, often the very first frontline interfacing with them. What kind of training do they have? So we believe our partners were being underutilized, that we think that there's lots of leverage and the force multiplier of getting together with our municipal departments on equality of training and common language and interoperability. When they come onto our campus, what we've heard when we've talked to them, and I knew this being a former police officer, they're unsure and unclear what we do, meaning when they're responding, what's the level of professionalism? Are we collecting evidence, not collecting evidence? Do we know how to speak properly on the radio? How are we interfacing with them? And that concern can go away with, you know, the proper training and interface with them. The governor's task force has started this conversation. There's been presentations there. Jim was there. So that's encouraging and good. So that dialogue's been opened. And our mission, again, is to further those interests where we can gain traction and make an inroad. So we figure it's the long ball rather than, you know, getting something done immediately. We know it's going to take a paradigm shift and some thought process. So I've touched on a little bit about the authorities and how do we partner. So the training piece, the vetting, the screening, the verified, are we doing psychologicals? Are we doing backgrounds? What's the hiring process? Who should have authority of that? Who should weigh in on that? I think it should be looked at professionally. How do we communicate during an emergency? Since 9/11, DHS has established guidance on Project 25, P25 radios, you know, the state's standing up their digital radio system. We are part of that radio system. Are we in? Are we not? You know, do we have the money to buy those radios? That kind of thing. Because when the event happens, it's between 1 and 3 minutes, typically, on a very acute incident. So these are some of the things we're talking about. And the trainings and standards speak to that. If we're all on the same sheet of music, law enforcement, campus public safety. Anything to add to that?
Yes, I would. I'd like to make a comment about that. So right now in the state of Oregon, a college, let's say a community college, they may decide that their officers have to do the 14-hour DPSST training. There's a criminal record check. They submit fingerprints. They go to their class for 2 days. And that is the level of training they might be delivering to their campus in a very complex world. The work that we do as public safety officers on community college campuses, at least at our college and some other colleges, it's dynamic and as complex as regular sworn law enforcement. I am a trained police officer from Minnesota. I've had post-certification. That's where I come from, and I worked for the Minneapolis Police Department for a while commanding police officers, so that's my background. But my point is that when you don't have any baseline standard to really address the complexities and the nuances of a very complex threat environment that can exist on a college campus like Central Michigan University today and like other schools, then you're asking for trouble, because there's a school that's going to do the minimum. Maybe that's based on what they can afford. Maybe that's based on their understanding of what the threat environment is. Maybe that's just based on their perceptions and administration or their leanings. But it doesn't change the fact that the threats they'll deal with are the same threats, or maybe the same threats that I deal with at Lane Community College. It may be the same threats that another community college deals with or that a municipality deals with. And so, you know, at our school, as I said, we tried to examine the best training regimen that we could, which was 400 hours for us. Now, compare that to the 14 hours. And how do we respond, and who has the capability to respond, and do we have interoperability for radio systems, and can we work and earn the respect of law enforcement, and do they trust us? Is there a standard for backgrounds? Do I just submit fingerprints and a criminal record check? Is that enough? Do we need to have psychologicals? Well, we do. But another college may not, because it's not regulated. There's no statute that would require them to do that. And yet they would still have the same challenges and threats, maybe in different numbers, than the school that where I work. So it's just something for you to think about. There's a lack of regulation in terms of minimums that would make people, give people confidence and the abilities and capabilities and capacities to address some of these issues. Sorry.
Oh, thank you.
So let me do a time check. We're supposed to go to quarter till, so we have about 15 minutes. I can probably push it for another 2 or 3 after that, but I do know that many of us have 10 o'clock that we have to be at.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll be able to make that time.
Okay.
No problem. So this next slide, this is just a reference data point for you. This is from Bureau of Justice and Statistics, federal government. It's 2012, but that's the latest data they have. What's important about this, we didn't present it, is the previous data shows an upward trend in percentages. These are getting higher and higher. It's just an information point. Not everyone wants to be an armed police department, but that's what's going on across the United States right now. So now we're actually to the core of it. The preliminary discussion we've had now is our actual six-point legislative proposal, what we're recommending based on what we've shared with you so far. So we mentioned the ORS, the statutory authority. So you saw those three or four before on that other slide. So what we're recommending is some level of comparative language that essentially equates to the university security or public safety. So that's 352.118. That would be a reference point. And educational institutions can manage those issues. It's difficult for us because of the legal constraints, depending on if you're a private, a college, or a university. Citizens' arrest is allowed. That's not the appropriate nor most effective tool. And even though there's the Good Samaritan piece to that, if you're in a uniform, are you immune? There's some challenges with that. So that would clean that up. Currently the authorities have probable cause arrest where appropriate. Public and private do not. So we're recommending changing that, cleaning that up. Training,
Chair,
yes.
Chair, can I ask a question about that? The difference between university and community college there, is that just an accident of legislative history, or is there any kind of rationale for it? Because off the top of my head, I don't really see a rationale.
We don't either, sir.
We may have a lifeline in the room, so we'll come back to that.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great question. We tried to figure that one out and don't know. Okay, very good. Training. So we spoke at length about training. We believe that whether it's a DPSST model or one that we're proposing that we can construct ourselves based on our experience and training that we have, that those standards need to be consistent, and we're proposing them on a graduated level. So nothing is mandated. There should be a floor. There could be a ceiling, which is sworn law enforcement, and DPSST controls that, 620 hours plus or minus, whatever that is now, and a certification. So what those levels would have a licensure or certification aligned with those standards. Basic, intermediate, and advanced could be a way to look at it. You can retain that private security provider that Jace spoke about, and no school would be required to do anything. There could be recommendations on best practices. So a sworn police agency, we're saying essentially here that model should be available for everybody. And it's up to the institution to make that risk analysis. I mean, the state could guide that, but we're saying don't take it away, expand it. Privates, colleges, and universities, if they want, and if they go through the appropriate recommended training and certification. And then, of course, there would be public accountability, right? Privates, the publics and the colleges have to disclose internal affairs. Certain things have to be disclosed. Privates, there may be an element in there that would have to get looked at. If you stand up a police department, then you have to do all these other things. Qualified immunity, I referenced citizens' arrest, but qualified immunity is important because if we're going to train and then hold people accountable, and then policies and procedures follow it, and then they're acting in good faith and under law, and you can point back to training, there should be a level of qualified immunity commensurate with what police officers get. Any comments on that?
No.
So the 352.118 doesn't specifically call out a warrant, but we're suggesting this would go to the overall threat assessment risk analysis picture of what's happening in our communities. If someone has a valid arrest warrant, number one, it's nice to know. but also probably should make that arrest, have the ability to make the arrest if you have the appropriate training, certification, your agency head wants it done, the vice president of the institution, president of the institution thinks that it's safe to do it. There's some complexities of do you have a backup officer or not when handcuffs go on people, but the idea here is do we allow a person with a warrant to walk away from a public space when they've been contacted, or the philosophy is, no, we mitigate that threat by taking that person into custody. The warrant is issued by a judge. So.
And I would like to comment on that. And currently, when we contact people, we have LEDs, and we find out they have a warrant, unless we can delay them until we can get a sworn partner to arrive, we let felons go, because there's no statutory authority that grants us the privilege of arresting them. And it did happen at Lane, I think for probably 20 years, we did arrest folks on warrants, unknowingly, that was prior to my arrival, and then actually during part of my arrival. And then we had an incident where one of our felons who was a pedophile and a strangler of children got away from us. He was also a weightlifter, got away from us. And at that point, our administration looked at what we were doing, and in a conversation with the DA, we decided we were not going to arrest on warrants. There was no statutory protection for it. It wasn't exactly prohibited by citizen, for a citizen to do that. And it sort of defies common sense. If you have a trained individual and they believe they can take a person into custody, which we had done for years and years and years, why wouldn't you want that done? It's in the interest of public safety. So that's my comment.
Oh, thank you, Jace. LEDs, he mentioned LEDs, law enforcement data system. It's a computer-based system, highly secured. You have to have certification and training. Most officers, almost 100% probably have it, dispatchers have it. This would be an access system. It can be controlled by the agency head, and it would be what law enforcement sees. Go to the next one. We're getting near the end here, so I think we're on time, I hope. So our rationale, essentially, again, it's to provide the highest level of safety that we can right now with the tools that currently exist, maybe with some minor tweaks in the ORS and some other strategies around training and certification. Our view is it doesn't seem equitable the way it's currently structured, that there's these varying levels of service delivery. And why would that be if all of our citizens and community members can travel across the state of Oregon and they can be anywhere? It seems that it would make sense that they should have equal levels or close to equal levels of safety or a perception of safety as they travel through the state. So it'll reduce the burden on law enforcement officers by making us more professional, making them less wary of what our abilities are. It'll be a force multiplier, strengthening these networks of communication. There are these silos of communication. There is not a free flow of information. Somebody gets off a bus in the city of Bend and commits a crime, we may be blind to that on our campus, or our campus may not communicate with the city of Bend. It's probably good to share that information. Increasing interoperability, we spoke about that. And the threat environment's only going to increase, not decrease. I'd love to live in a world where it decreases, but I don't think so right now. So our challenges are getting more complicated. We have those very serious crimes occurring on our campuses right now. I believe I provided some data in the data sheets on this. While it's a very, very safe place to be, you never know. Active shooters, violent actors, you know, we've spoken about that. So our proposals, we believe, will provide a nice structure, framework, footprint to solve a lot of these problems. Certainly make the campuses safer. So this is equally important, what's not being proposed, and we're almost here at the end. We're not mandating higher education institutions to do certain things beyond their level of control, budget, what their interests are. That's their risk analysis. Prevent institutions from strong bonds with municipal law enforcement. Some already have great relationships. We don't want to alter that. We're suggesting providing opportunities to increase those. And enhancement of authority where appropriate training and standards have not been established. This is where we've identified the biggest gaps we see. And we don't believe it's going to require any new money. We think that we have the access to what we need, and institutions have access to what we need to make all of these things happen that we shared with you today. So we would like to do, if you have action items for us, great, let us know. But we would like to do anything we can, that is the mission of our association, to help support, assist, lobby, deploy, write training. We've already written some. We just haven't put it out there. So we have a legislative committee. Jace is our chair. We have our, a media committee and
training committee.
So Susie Pent-Tannenbaum, the chief of Oregon State in Corvallis, is leading our training committee, and she's a former DPSST supervisor. So we're in the process of just reaching out. This is one huge piece, and I think that kind of brings us to the very last piece. Look at that. Hopefully we made the time.
Beautiful, you did. We have time for some questions. Senator Dembro did ask a question. Dana, I'm not going to ask you to come up right this second, but I don't know if you heard the question. If you do, I'm going to bring you up so we can put something on the record. But before this panel moves on, any questions for anyone on the panel?
Just, I do have one. Thanks, yeah. Mr. Chair. Sorry for asking all these questions. But, you know, one of the really prevalent and difficult situations that we see on campuses is where we have students who are being protected by a stalking order. Mm-hmm. You know, they're in a domestic violence or, you know, partner kind of problem. And, you know, I've had the experience where I've had students who've just disappeared because they didn't want to be in a place where they were known to be, you know, even though they were protected by a stalking order. You know, restraint kind of thing. So, you know, I'm wondering, that has got to be a real challenge for public safety. And, you know, what can you do to make sure that people feel safe? Do you automatically get that information when a student is protected by an order?
Yes, Senator, I'm sorry, did I interrupt you?
No, okay. Go ahead.
So, without giving you names, right, all confidential, we've had a series of incidents. So, the judge, the person goes and gets the restraining order, and that person's a student. The other party, the restrained party, may or may not be a student, but they're going to come on the campus. So what was interesting to me last year, judge issued the order, and at that time in that courtroom, it was 100 feet, let's say. But 100 feet on a campus, that means basically you're stalking that person on the campus, right? They stay 101 feet away. We have a tool at our institution called an exclusion notice. So I worked with our legal team, and I excluded the person from the campus. So that's just an interesting tool internally that we could use. So they had a criminal, if you will, restraining, or it's really civil, I suppose. So it is a problem. It happens all the time because, again, we're a subset of your communities elsewhere. We have assistance with them. We can provide separate places they park. We can walk with them to and from. But it is a complete and total disruption. If you're looking over your shoulder all the time, they do live in fear. Jace, you had a comment?
Sure. Well, what we do is we get a copy of the restraining order, or we assist student, staff, faculty in getting the restraining order. We give them a safety plan. We sit down with them. An officer will go over in length the things they can do, including things at home, things in transit, things on campus, counter surveillance. Personal safety. We go over that in detail and provide them a list of resources as well. So we're aware that the restraining order is intact. We have a BOLO board for officers to be on the lookout board. So we'll have images of individuals that are of interest to us if they're not already associated with the campus. And of course, we're working with our student affairs professionals to make sure that there are appropriate boundaries if the person already is a student, and depending on the, you know, the distance involved and the nature of the incident. And of course, we do threat assessments. And one of the tools we use when we do threat assessments for criminality is the LEDs. So we'll take a look and see, has this person been violent? Have they done other things? Are they wanted right now? Do they have a probation officer that we can reach out to? And that's very handy, but it's a very holistic approach. And it is something real that happens, unfortunately, with some frequency. Thank you for the question, Senator.
All right. Any other questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much for your presentations. Dana, why don't you go ahead and come on up, and then when she gets up here, Senator Dembro, if you can go ahead and pose your question once again so we can have that in sync.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for
your
time.
Thank you, Shauna, for helping us out. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the Judiciary Committee.
All right, just a second. Senator Dembro, why don't you pose your question so we'll do the Q&A.
I have it.
You have it?
Yeah.
Okay. Then why don't you refresh us for the questions so we can have that as part of the record.
Okay. For the record, my name's Dana Richardson. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Presidents, a voluntary association of Oregon's public university presidents. And I believe that Senator Dembrough's question had to do with kind of, I think the term was inconsistencies between the university statutes and the community college statutes. And I don't believe those are actually inconsistencies. What I think they really are is a legacy and a reflection of the different governance systems in place. Obviously, the universities are coming out of the chancellor system. The community colleges for a long time have had their boards that are locally elected. And I think these questions about whether or not to have what types of officers you have on campus, what sorts of authorities they have, is very much a locally driven conversation, particularly with the colleges. It's been controversial and not something that all of the boards feel the same about. And then in the universities, I think it's a newly posed question since the dissolution of the chancellor's office.
As usual, Dana has given me the answer I wanted to hear.
So, all right. And the other thing I will just say is that as we've gone through this process, there has been, as Dana says, a lot of questions and concerns as to what each of the smaller universities or community colleges actually want and what they feel comfortable with. I really appreciate the presentation with the understanding that a lot of it is something that would be optional and it would be voluntary for different campuses to consider. This too will be something I think will be an ongoing process for discussions because as we reflect on this, there wouldn't be a requirement for legislative change to see some of this to go forward to give those options. Any other questions or comments? All right. We're going to go ahead and close the informational hearing. And at this point, we'll be closing the Senate Judiciary Committee due to our time frame and what we expect to be happening this weekend. I expect this is our last of our informational meetings during this short session. And so we'll be back in the Capitol during the legislative day scheduled. I think it's the third week of May, but we'll make sure everyone gets an invitation. With that, we're closed.